WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The shootings at Sandy Hook Elementary have focused attention on mental health care in America. North Carolina has been in the process of reforming its mental health care system for several years. It is now guided by a strategy of providing services in local communities, reserving the state's three large psychiatric hospitals for patients needing long-term care. But that means communities around the state have the need now for hospitals and psychiatric units capable of providing short-term inpatient care and care for those who are temporarily unstable. We wondered how that's working out, and we're taking a look at it this hour, this relatively new effort. We're joined by Meban Rash and John Quinterno. Meban is editor of Insight North Carolina, the journal for the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research, and co-author of Serving Mental Health Patients in Crisis. She joins us with the other co-author of that paper, John Quinterno, principal with South by North Strategies. They're both in the studios at WUNC in Durham. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having us.
And before we talk about mental health, Mr. Quinterno, what is South by North Strategies, and how is it connected either to the topic or to the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research?
South by North Strategies is a small public policy research firm in Chapel Hill, and we've collaborated with the Center for Public Policy Research on a variety of projects, and we worked with them on to contribute to this set of research they've been doing around mental health issues.
And I said a moment ago that North Carolina has been in the process of reforming its mental health care system for several years. One element of this, the three-way contract system, was initiated in 2008, but North Carolina started in on mental health care reform in 2001. Why? What was the impetus for reform back then?
So back in 1999, the U.S. Supreme Court handed down what's referred to commonly as the Olmstead decision. And that decision set in motion mental health care reform, both nationwide and in North Carolina. And what the Supreme Court said was that patients had to be treated in the least restrictive setting possible. So they needed to be treated in their communities rather than institutions. So that set in motion North Carolina passing its mental health reform law in 2001.
So being treated in a local setting closer to home is less restrictive in some way than being in a large psychiatric hospital? Why?
Yes, community settings. So the patients are closer to home. They're closer to their local care providers and their families. Their support system is in place to support them as they transition back into the community. I think we also see that we want people living on their own as much as possible. And so one of the things this project did was look at a public-private partnership between the state and local hospitals where we're buying short-term crisis beds so that if people needed help, for instance, they can be treated for 7 days or less and then move back into their community placements.
Well, the law that made this happen, what took place in 2000, the change began in 2001, but it was in 2008 that the legislature provided funds for the then new program called three-way contracts. What had been in place for those 7 years in between?
Well, I think one of the issues we were getting at there is going back to what Meban said a moment ago, the move to provide services in the community also required efforts to build the capacity in the community. So I think over those earlier periods, you were seeing different steps being put in place. But by the time 2008, 2009 came around, I think there was a realization that one important piece that was missing in many communities, if you were going to build these continuum of cares, was having the short-term beds that would be available for folks who had were in short-term crisis and required a level of inpatient care. So I think the movement was, over those earlier periods, you were putting the building blocks in place, if you will, to varying degrees of success. And then we reached the point where this was an important piece that was missing, and the attempt was made to put it in place.
So we have these. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
About 5 years ago, there were still about 18,500 people that were being treated in the state psychiatric hospitals. That number now is down to less than 6,000. So the question still is building capacity, mm-hmm. and where do those people go? And without local crisis beds in communities, we think the answer is to emergency rooms and jails and prison, and that's how they're accessing mental health services. So mm-hmm. this project that we looked at is really key in, as John said, building that local capacity so short-term care can be provided in communities across North Carolina.
So we have these three-way contracts. How does this system work? What are these three-way contracts? What does that mean?
I mean, the way they were originally set up was that it was a partnership involving the state, the local management entities that are responsible for overseeing and administering mental health services in different areas of the state, and community hospitals. And the basic structure was that you'd put in place a contract where you would essentially provide funding to community hospitals that had inpatient psychiatric capacity that they were looking to essentially expand and to provide those services in the community. So the reimbursement, the hospitals would provide the services, the state would provide the funding, and then the local partner would be the connection between the two through which the administration and funding and contracts and money all moved around.
Is there any kind of a system for other types of health care that mirrors this or is like this in any way?
Well, I think one of the things that's – I mean, you hear a lot about all of the problems with North Carolina's mental health system. And one of the reasons we wanted to look at this program is it's a pretty novel approach and might be a national model. Mm-hmm. It really does create kind of a win-win for the different stakeholders. So as required by the Supreme Court decision, patients are treated closer to home where their support networks are already in place. We also see that they're transferred into those beds more quickly from the ER than they are to state psychiatric hospital beds. The hospitals receive payment for treating patients who are otherwise uninsured. The LMEs are able to strengthen their continuum of care for those in crisis within their community. And the state reduces the short-term admissions to state psychiatric hospitals, saves money, and furthers the broader goals of mental health reform.
I guess what I'm getting at here is these three-way contracts and these LMEs, which I want to define in a second, these local mental health management entities. This seems like unlike anything else in healthcare, and I'm just wondering why. Why don't we do the same thing if you have an appendix, or do we, for if you have an acute appendicitis attack or you have a heart attack?
Well, the hospitals are going to provide those services as part of their own provision of services for their community. I think the question comes in with mental health care is these are very expensive services for the hospital to provide. And some local hospitals had the capacity, the infrastructure to provide it, but their business model wasn't supporting the provision of service of these services. And so the state came up with this idea as a way to reimburse them. They're paying the hospital $750 a day, and that covers the room, the physician, and the medication on discharge for the client, for a patient that would otherwise be uninsured. And so for small hospitals, it gives them a way to make this work.
Why is this more expensive than taking care of a patient with a physical ailment?
Well, I think one of the issues we're dealing with here, and that what is important to point out, is that the patients who are being served under these under this program are individuals who are in crisis, who are generally at a stage where they would likely have to receive some sort of involuntary commitment because they become a danger temporarily to themselves or others. Mm-hmm. And to be served, you have to be essentially indigent and uninsured. So even in the private hospital setting, you're dealing with patients who probably would not, by definition, would not have the ability, did not have private insurance, and probably lack the means to pay for the services anyway. So what the contracts do is provide a financial incentive for the hospitals to continue to provide services to folks who probably otherwise would not be able to compensate the hospital in one way or form for those services. And I think where the real value is, in a way, is, as Mebben pointed out earlier, for many of these individuals, if they wound up in crisis without the hospital beds, they would wind up essentially going into the criminal justice system in some capacity and or then potentially being transported to the state psychiatric hospitals, which could potentially be very far away from their communities. And also it's expensive to serve folks in those facilities. And also it imposes a lot of cost on your local government, particularly your local criminal justice agencies, with the transport of moving people back and forth. So for all those reasons, when you look at the bigger picture, you can actually say this is a very cost-effective approach because you're keeping people in the community at a fixed rate. that's reimbursing hospitals for services they may not otherwise have been received any payment for, and it saves the public all of the costs of the criminal justice element, as well as actually the services that would be provided once folks were transported to a state psychiatric hospital, assuming there was capacity available to help them at one of those facilities. So I think you have to put it in those contexts as well.
That makes it not only a public health issue, but a public safety issue. So what kinds of cases are we talking about, psychiatric cases or mental health cases, are we talking about being handled in this way?
So these are people that are in short-term crisis. They need treatment that's usually going to be able to be provided in 7 days or less. They're often psychotic, suicidal. They may pose a risk to others, or they may need treatment for substance abuse.
Mm-hmm. Okay. These LMEs, these local mental health management entities, is that just a broad title for any type of institution that will be able to take care of these people, or is it just is it shorthand for hospitals?
Well, no, it's not shorthand for hospitals. So the local governance model has changed 3 times since mental health care reform. I think it's been very hard for people to wrap their minds around the different changes. But we started out with 39 area authorities. And then we had 23 local management entities. And you can think of those as the regional entities that managed mental health services for the state. We're transitioning away from that yet again into something that's going to be called MCOs, or managed care organizations. Interestingly to me, none of these things tell the consumer anything about that they're the providers of mental health or behavioral health services in North Carolina. So the titles have changed. I don't know who comes up with these acronyms, but
government
they're basically
people.
the regional entities that are managing mental health services for the state.
Why does it keep changing?
Because the state has chosen to do that. I mean, I think one of the bigger problems with mental health care reform is the state's inability to stay the course, any course. And many things have changed. Our provider model has changed. Our funding model has changed. This local governance model has changed 3 times. There have been a lot of leadership shifts. The change from LMEs to MCOs is happening as part of the funding change and the move to the federal Medicaid waiver. And so these managed care organizations are going to operate basically like small insurance companies, which is a whole different skill set.
And the federal Medicaid waiver is what?
The federal Medicaid waiver is a new way that North Carolina is going to fund its public system of mental health care. So it's called a waiver because it waives certain federal regulations. Basically, what's going to happen is there are now going to be 11 managed care organizations statewide, and the state is going to pay those managed care organizations a fee, a set fee per consumer served. And that's instead of our old model in which that's where the state paid a fee for service, for the service that was provided. So the idea is that the local management entity MCO is going to get this capitated rate, the set amount of money for each person served, and they're going to be responsible for providing all of the public mental health services that are needed in a community. They're hoping that the MCOs will be able to recruit providers, incent them to provide the array of services that a particular community needs, and that they'll be able to save enough money along the way to provide some extra services that make this an attractive option. It's the reason the state has wanted to do this is to get a handle on the Medicaid funding and have a set amount of money that they know is going to be used for mental health Medicaid funding statewide.
Mebin Rash is editor of North Carolina Insight. It's a part of a publication of the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research. John Quinterno is a principal with South by North Strategies. They're both co-authors of Serving Mental Health Patients in Crisis. We're going to come back and ask a zillion more questions about this arcane business of mental health care in North Carolina in just a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony in concert with Tiempo Libre, the Grammy-nominated Cuban music group, performing a rich cultural music tradition February 22nd and 23rd in the Belk Theater. Tickets at 704-972-2000. Now, we know that there is an obesity epidemic in America, and even before we knew that, people talked all the time about dieting, particularly in the beginning of the year. Perhaps the secret to healthy living is healthy living, one that involves diet and exercise, and one expert suggests we eat like a caveman and exercise like one, too. We talk about living the paleo lifestyle tomorrow at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Sonia Sotomayor is the first Hispanic and third woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. Justice Sotomayor, on her journey from a Bronx housing project to the nation's highest court.
Join the Diane Rehm Show for that discussion this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Mebben Rash and John Quinterno, both co-authors of Serving Mental Health Patients in Crisis. It's a paper put out by the, I guess it's put out by the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research about the shifting sands of mental health care here in this state. A couple of terms have come up in the last 20 minutes that might be, as I said off the air to my producer, my head's going to explode this morning. This is so complex.
So imagine being a consumer
yes,
in crisis.
Exactly.
And just for instance, if you're a consumer and you go to the division's website, the Division of Mental Health, and you look at the chart that they have for how to access mental health services in North Carolina, there are 16 steps and 16 different acronyms, none of which a consumer would necessarily know.
Right. That's not deliberate. That's just some bureaucrat having fun with words.
I hope it changes.
Okay.
I just think part of that, to back up, though, is part of the reason I think the system is complex. And I agree with Mebben that, of course, from a consumer's perspective, it's not always very clear or transparent, especially when you're dealing with folks who are having some sort of crisis. But I think part of the reason you see some complexity is because we are dealing with very complicated, very serious issues in a way. Mm-hmm. If you look at it, you know, statewide, about an estimated 1.4 million people have a developmental disability, a mental health issue, or a substance abuse issue that they're dealing with. That's about 14% of the state's population. And overall, many of those issues that they're dealing with are complicated, and you are dealing then with this complicated array of federal funding and state programs and management and oversight, and then the changes we're trying to implement, changes in the legislative context, changes in staffing at agencies that occur over the past 10 years. So, I mean, part of the reason that there is a lot of complexity is because it is a very complex issue, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of that. But the bottom line is, how do we make sure services are available in the way we say we want them to be, locally available for the 1.4 million people in North Carolina who are in need of them and who are going to be consuming or need this kind of medical care.
And I think John's point is good. I mean, 300,000 of those are kids. And this is an issue that touches all of our lives, rich and poor, black and white, urban and rural, all ages, Republicans and Democrats. So, you know, with 14% of the population needing mental health care, headlines should not have to drive the changes in our mental health system anymore.
Is that average around the country, that 14% of the population requires mental health care? That seems like an awfully high number to me.
Well, it varies a bit. And the numbers we generated for North Carolina take some of national prevalence rates and then applied them for the different population categories to the state. So that's what we came up with.
A couple of terms have come up in the last 20 minutes. We started out with these local mental health management entities, these LMEs that were going to take care of mental health care in regions around the state. Now we're shifting toward managed care organizations statewide, 11 of them statewide. Are these essentially the same organizations with different names? And if so, what organizations in this region are we talking about that are involved in this practice or this policy or this what I don't know what to call it?
Well, so they're essentially the same organizations, except that the 23 LMEs have collapsed into 11 MCOs. So there's been a lot of consolidation. And then also the services, as I mentioned, the MCOs are going to function much more like small insurance companies. So the way they're going to operate is very different. And the skill sets that their employees are going to have are going to be very different. The one that's in your area is MechLink. Mm-hmm. That's the one that's trying to get up, and they're hoping it's going to be operating by March 1st.
Now, yeah. They're not a hospital. What exactly is MechLink?
MechLink is the managed care organization that is going to handle the federal Medicaid waiver for your local area.
The county in Mecklenburg.
So the state is going to pay MechLink a set amount of money for each consumer that's going to need mental health services in their area. And MechLink is going to be responsible for recruiting the providers that are going to actually provide the services and incenting them to provide the services that the consumers in your region need.
So would consumers ever interface with MechLink, or are they simply a liaison between the state and the provider?
I would just say that I think the idea is that these organizations are going to be the ones that try to manage the budget and the finance.
Right.
And it's essentially in a way like the managed care model we've seen in other forms of health care at different times.
The consumers will interact with them. So MechLink will be the one that decides if the consumer is eligible for care through the state public system of care.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that's interesting about this waiver model is we had one region that has functioned this way for I think about 8 years. And what we saw was that in that case, the MCO actually became more of an advocate for consumers in terms of being able to say, we've got this money, we need providers to serve this person. And so they became an advocate for the consumer in terms of recruiting a provider that would provide the services needed for particular people.
And you also mentioned we're shifting from, I don't know what the original plan was, but they paid one rate per patient to a fee. We're going from fee for service to one fee per patient, no matter what service is provided. Is that accurate?
That's right.
So when you do that, is there any evidence as to what happens to the kind of care that person gets? Because it seems to me if you're getting a fee per service, you're liable to make more money from the state than you would if you just get X amount of dollars no matter what you do.
Well, I think just one thing to back up, when we talk about the fee for service versus other formats, I think it's important to remember we are talking about individuals who have insurance through the Medicaid program. So that's the population that's being spoken about right there. So we're not talking about all people with mental health services or all folks who are dealing with issues. Other folks may have private insurance, whatnot, or be covered in other ways. We're talking in this context specifically about the individuals who are insured through the Medicaid program. So I think that's just a contextual piece to keep in mind.
So this should not affect the kind of care or the amount of care that these people would get under these new terms?
In theory, hopefully, they're going to actually get better care.
Okay.
And more services will be able to be provided. So what happens is they get a set amount of money for each of the consumers they serve. And that amount of money is based on an average of how much that person has needed over a certain amount of time. And in other places where this has worked, the managed care organization has been able to, you know, some people won't need that level of service that month or that quarter. And so they've been able to generate some savings over time. And they've done a couple different things with that. One is they've built up risk reserves so that in times when their population needs more services than they've expected, they have money to cover that. But they've also been able to provide additional services outside the normal scope of care that are approved by the federal government.
I think that's the important thing to keep in mind, too, is that essentially the organizations are getting a pot of money that they're responsible for managing, but they're also bearing a lot of the risk. If you wind up, as Mevin was just saying, maybe your service population changes, you have your expenditures wind up being higher for whatever reasons, the risk of sort of running over your set amounts rests with the local organization.
And that's one of the things I think I'm most worried about with this transition to the federal Medicaid waiver. I heard some policymakers talking about this in December, and that's what they've said all along, is that the managed care organizations will bear the risk, and that's why they're building up these risk reserves. But then I heard one of the directors of the managed care organization say, well, let's be clear, we bear the risk, but if we run over and we don't have the reserves to cover it, we just give up the contract, and the state is ultimately on the hook. Well, that's a pretty big difference in terms of how you're thinking about risk, and makes me wonder if the state needs to also be building up risk reserves.
Wow. Your report. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think one other thing is important just to back up for a little more contextual piece. I mean, we talked a moment ago about – we've talked about some of the different moving parts, Mike. But I think we – getting back to the big picture, you know, as we said earlier, we have about 1.4 million people in North Carolina who are in need of mental health or developmental disability or substance abuse services. About a million or so of those are adults. And if you look for the adults and the mental health with the mental health issues, a little over half of those are treated through our public system very broadly. So when we talk about some of the issues, whether it's of the kind of Medicaid program we were talking about a moment ago or the different state facilities around the state, that sort of gives you a sense of we're not necessarily even talking about a sort of a niche population where the state system plays a very important role in the overall provision of mental health, developmental disability, and substance abuse services in the state. So it's important to keep that sort of perspective in mind.
Your report, Serving Mental Health Patients in Crisis, is the first independent evaluation of this statewide initiative to reform mental health care in North Carolina. What prompted you to do this study now?
Well, I think from our perspective, I mean, we again, with the three-way bed piece, we are not looking at the entire system. We are looking at one particular program mm-hmm. that was put in place in 2008-09 to try to deal with one issue and filling one or helping to build one part of the continuum of care we alluded to at the beginning of the show. And so that's something to keep in mind. We're not. This does not look at the whole system. The center has been doing other work that looks at the more comprehensive approach. But with the three-way bed piece, we were looking at that one individual piece, and we took it on, I think, because at the time we started doing the work, it was a new program. As Mebben referenced earlier, it seemed very promising, but possibly a national model, and we wanted to see what the early experiences were and if there are any lessons that we could learn to either make it better going forward or to help inform the larger process of mental health reform in North Carolina. So that was sort of, I think, the impetus.
So now that you've done this study and you've published this study, Mebben, are you still optimistic that this holds promise to be a national model? Is it working out the way you thought it was before you started the study?
I think we found, you know, what we said was that we found it was a qualified success. I feel very good about this program. And I think, you know, one of the things that we would like to see is as money becomes more available and the economy recovers, does this program need to be expanded? But John interviewed stakeholders across North Carolina, and they did have some concerns, and they made some important comments. And, you know, we included those in recommendations in our report, and we'll be taking those recommendations to legislators and making them aware of them. It's not that the program is perfect. It does need to be modified and tweaked over the years. And one of our recommendations is now that we're 5 years in and we've spent about $125 million on the program, there needs to be a more formal evaluation, ongoing evaluation of this program where we're looking at program and patient outcomes so that we can make some good decisions about this program both in North Carolina and nationwide.
Yeah, you're recommending the development of outcome measures for the program. You want them to track both the numbers of patients served as well as the outcome of the care they receive. And I'm just curious why this wasn't automatically part of the legislation. We're putting forth all this state funding for this program. Why wouldn't the state want to know if they're throwing good money after bad or whether it's actually money well spent?
Well, I think with what we were talking about with some of our suggestions there on the measures were not so much to say that the state was not tracking where the money was going and being accountable, but it was more of the idea of now that we know several years in what's happened and we've seen some of the development of the program, can we put some additional measures or some new look at these issues in a way that aligns them a little more closely with the overall goals that we've set out for the mental health system. So one of the theories behind the move to the three-way contract was this would help reduce short-term admissions at our state mental health hospitals, for example. So trying to really take what we've learned so far, the successes, and then see if we can measure them a little more accurately and align them a little more put them in more alignment with some of the overarching goals we've set out for ourselves as we've gone from a pilot program essentially to one that is spending a good part of money and is active in a significant portion of the state now.
You mentioned that North Carolina has had a problem over this reform period in mental health of stick-to-itiveness. They keep changing the way they do business here. And I'm curious as to how likely the Republican legislature and Republican Governor Pat McCrory are to be friendly to what's going on now, or will they want to change this yet again?
Well, I think what we would encourage them to do is, as a team, pick a strategy, implement it, fund it, and then leave it in place long enough for us to see if it works and evaluate it. Medicaid is the largest provider of funding for mental health services, both in the nation and in North Carolina. So I think Republican policymakers and all policymakers are going to be interested in this issue because Medicaid's also the biggest growing program in our state budget. And so I don't think you'll see them change their minds about the federal Medicaid waiver, for instance, because that has the most promise of containing Medicaid costs for the state on mental health issues.
And, of course, the Affordable Care Act is kicking in 2014, and they're setting up the exchanges, the healthcare exchanges, in October of this year. What impact is the arrival of this new federal program likely to have on this program, if any at all?
Well, I think one issue that comes into play is the debate about whether or not the state should participate in the expansion of the Medicaid program mm-hmm. to cover more low-income individuals who are not currently covered, which the federal government will bear all of the cost of for the next several years. And that would have an impact on this in a way because the three-way bed project, as we mentioned earlier, by definition serves people who are indigent and uninsured. And those are the types of folks who would potentially qualify for Medicaid under the expanded program. So you would move people who don't have insurance currently and are using these contracts into the insured category.
So there are two different issues with the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid expansion. One is North Carolina's Medicaid rolls, the number of people who are on Medicaid, is going to go up no matter what because there are people who are currently eligible but are not on Medicaid. And those health care exchanges that you mentioned are going to identify those people and they're going to be signed up for Medicaid. The other question that John alluded to is whether the Republican leadership in North Carolina decides to opt into the Medicaid expansion. And that would create a newly eligible group of people in North Carolina. And I think that's the big looming question that we're all interested in on this issue is what they decide to do about that. You know, I worry that they're not going to do that because we haven't been able to contain the Medicaid costs enough already. And are they likely to add additional populations that would drive up those costs if they don't feel like they've got the containment measures in place?
Now, the two of you wrote about a specific portion of reform, but I believe one of you mentioned that the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research has been looking into all of mental health care in North Carolina. And if that's the case, and if you know the answer to this, I'd like to know how North Carolina stacks up in terms of the services it provides in the mental health care arena to other states in the country.
Right. So, yeah, the center is a nonpartisan research group in Raleigh, North Carolina, and we look at the most important issues facing North Carolina. Our board, interestingly, looks just like the state. So in terms of race, gender, political party from the East, West, and Piedmont, and they pick our issues. And it was in 2009 that they decided that we were going to conduct a five-year look at mental health issues in North Carolina. So the first piece of our project was a historical look at mental health reform in North Carolina. It looked all the way back to the days of Dorothea Dix.
Hmm. I tell you what, you hear the music,
we'll
you know we're coming up.
Up
to a break. Yes, we'll pick it up on the other side, a little history lesson, and then we'll delve a little more into your report on mental health patients in crisis. Mebben Rash and John Quinterno, our guests, we're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Founders Federal Credit Union, an innovative credit union with 24 offices across the Carolinas and over 90 ATMs in its network. Information available at foundersfcu.com. And North Carolina Dance Theater's innovative works, five new contemporary dance works in the intimate 701 North Tryon Theater, including a reception with the professional dancers. Now through February 16th, tickets at ncdance.org. Sonia Sotomayor, the first Hispanic and third third woman appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, is the guest on the Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes. She joins Diane to talk about her journey from a Bronx housing project to the nation's highest court. If you'd like to join our conversation right now, 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
When you roll out of bed, bleary-eyed, maybe groggy, the first thing on your mind is getting something to wake you up. Turn on the radio. NPR's daily news program Morning Edition has been working through the night to get you the news you need to start your day right. It could be as essential to your morning as a good cup of coffee. Hit the ground running with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekdays starting at 5 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Mebben Rush and John Quinterno are with us. They are the co-authors of Serving Mental Health Patients in Crisis. Mebben is the editor of North Carolina Insight, a publication of the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research. John is principal with South by North Strategies. And I asked a question just prior to the break about how North Carolina stacks up to other states in the country in terms of services provided and mental health care and how we do with the outcomes. And you were in the middle of giving us a little history lesson, Mebben.
Right. So the first phase of our project looked backwards and looked at the history of mental health reform in North Carolina all the way back to Dorothea Dix. This part of our project that's been recently released includes a look at, you know, where we are right now in North Carolina. And it also includes the work by John on this particular program, the three-way bed contracts. And then going forward, we are going to look at how North Carolina stacks up to other states. We had a researcher that we sent to six other states. We didn't find any state that we thought was just the best at providing mental health care. I think that goes back to John saying that this is a really complicated issue. And you can look at certain states and find things that they do really well and things that they do not so well. But we thought it was important to bring all of those experiences back to North Carolina and say and bring, you know, share those with the people who are running the mental health system here. And that'll be coming out. The other part of our research that John is helping us with is a look at the mental health workforce in North Carolina. So one of the things we realized is that the state does, imagine running a multi-million dollar company and not knowing some very basic information about your workforce, including like how many employees you have, are they aging, you know, do you have an adequate pipeline of workers in place to come in as they age? What percent of them are nurses, you know, and are they, is that going to be impacted by the state's nursing workforce shortage? And so John is also helping us look at that issue as well. And we'll be releasing those probably in 2013-2014.
Okay. One of your recommendations in your report is for the Secretary of the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services to develop a strategy to ensure timely payments under these contracts, because one of the complaints of service providers has been late payments. Why? Why is that a problem?
Well, I think going back to what Mebben said earlier when she just said our conclusion in many ways was that this program is a qualified success, I think when we talk about those things, where feedback was very positive was that the hospitals and the stakeholders liked the program overall. They were very happy with many of the services it provided. They were happy with the funding that was available, the extra capacity. And that's been reflected in the fact that progressively more and more providers have signed up for the program. So the criticisms that I guess we heard, or the concerns that were voiced, dealt with some of the structural issues. And one of those definitely dealt with some of the issues around timeliness of payment and some of the financial aspects of such a complicated program, which makes sense. And particularly a couple of years ago when the state's budget shortages were very severe, there were some concerns about payment being slowed down and all of those sorts of things and people not getting paid promptly. So we definitely believe that one of the things that the state needs to look at if they want this program to work and be successful is to look at some of those larger financial issues in the sense of just how they manage the bills and how they make sure that folks get paid in reasonable periods of time.
I think if you could talk to some of the hospitals, you would hear them say, take our recommendation, take it one step further. And they're actually asking for a two-way contract. They would like to cut out the LME, the MCO, as the middleman and have a direct relationship with the state in terms of billing and receiving payment.
How likely is that to happen now that we've shifted yet again from LMEs to, managed care organizations?
mean, I think there is a, I don't know if a philosophical question comes into play there, and, but the sense is originally we moved in, after the 2001 reform to a more locally managed system. The whole idea is we wanted to get out of the state sort of running mental health services at the at a centralized level and move it down or devolve it to a certain degree to the local level. So the question of sort of trying to cut out the local component is one of is one that I think's raises a lot of concern about, in a way, would we be going in sort of the wrong direction?
Okay.
Or the opposite direction of where we've been over the past 10 years.
Okay. Prior to 2001, people needing mental health care, as I understand it, for the most part, were sent to the one of three statewide mental health care hospitals. And now we have, as you say, localized it and created these entities that will take care of patients around the state, which is certainly good for the patient because it keeps them closer to home and doesn't institutionalize them in these massive hospitals. Does it also lower costs to either the state or the patients or to families?
Well, I think one of the things we saw in the report is, and not necessarily a causal link, but you know, when folks go and receive short-term care, if they're in crisis, at a community hospital, it's generally going to be less costly than if they were to go to a state hospital, particularly when you add in other things like transport costs. But also it does seem that, again, we didn't establish a causal link, but that some of the readmission rates and some of the other factors, outcomes are lower for folks who are served through the three-way contract. So in that way, it may help pull down the total cost of, you know, in the sense of if someone were admitted and then discharged and then readmitted again, the collective cost would be likely higher.
And so you just said that and you bring this out in the report, that readmission rates are lower than for those served in state hospitals. Do we understand at all why that would be?
Well, again, I would take that with a grain of salt because this report was not designed to establish the causal link, but there definitely seems to be something going on there, and I think additional research and work could help establish some of that.
You also recommend that the state's Department of Health and Human Services require state psychiatric hospitals to open their existing training programs for their own state employees to the local community hospitals participating in these three-way contracts. Where are local hospital employees in participating hospitals getting their training now?
So this I thought was a pretty good idea, and one that the state seems open to. So if you have 22 hospitals, local hospitals, small hospitals, community hospitals across the state providing this this type of care, and this is care that's hard to provide and hard to train people to provide, it makes a lot more sense for the state to open up their programs, that workforce training programs that exist at the state psychiatric hospitals already, to these workers at the local hospitals, rather than have the hospitals have to create those training programs themselves from the ground up in each of those 22 locations.
Okay, okay. As I said, my brain is going to explode here this morning.
Well, I think one of the things to keep in mind with the three-way contract program in general, because it involves community hospitals, is that community hospitals vary a great deal in terms of size and sophistication. In a big metro area like Charlotte, the hospitals there generally going to be at a scale where they can do a lot more. In some of the more rural parts of the state, the community hospitals are going to be much smaller. If they have a psychiatric unit that's participating in the project, they're going to typically have relatively small number of beds, small number of staff. It's not necessarily as feasible for them to provide some of that training on their own. And that's actually a bigger issue with this whole contract in a way. The economics and the incentive of the payment is going to vary a lot by where your hospital is where your hospital is.
So
the incentive might make a lot more in a rural area than it might in a big metro one.
So if we have these three big hospitals that have up until 2001 traditionally been taking care of anybody who needs to be taken care of in terms of mental health, and suddenly we're spreading that out all over the state, and we have to help train hospital personnel in smaller cities where they may not be equipped to do this, is this costing the state more money and the taxpayer more money to do it this way?
Well, I want to clarify that prior to 1999, there was community care in North Carolina. So we had 39 area authorities. And at that time, the area authorities not only determined whether people were eligible for services, but they were actually providing mental health treatment themselves. What changed in 1999 was this push to reduce the number of people that were being served in state psychiatric hospitals, and that for those that could be served in communities in more consumer-oriented treatments, to do that. And so that's what you've seen. That's where you've seen the drop. You know, if 18,500 people were being treated at the state psychiatric hospitals just 5 years ago, that number's down to less than 6,000.
Okay. We invited folks to join us. We're going to let Michael into the conversation. Michael, you're on WFAE. Welcome. Hello, Michael. Michael once, Michael twice. Hello, Michael. Goodbye, Michael. All right. An email from Bill in Matthews. It seems a big culprit in all of this is the pharmaceutical industrial complex, which is peddling drugs of all kinds for sometimes invented ailments with innumerable side effects. I'm not sure this has anything to do with this conversation, but we'll let you comment on this. The pharmaceutical industry owned the media by virtue of the advertising dollars spent on airtime and print ad space. They are complicit in all of this, and they know it. They are the new tobacco industry, and they should be better controlled. To me, a good first step would be to ban most pharmaceutical advertising, just like we did years ago in the tobacco industry. Does this really play a role in this conversation or in mental health in general or in specifics with North Carolina?
I mean, I don't necessarily know about the ban on advertising fitting in for what we looked at. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, one of the things that is important about this project and one of the things in mental health is that one of the issues that often causes people to move into one of these crisis moments where they might be served through one of the three-way contracts is because of issues around pharmaceuticals. Either their medications are off, they run out of their medications. Those issues do come into play in terms of if their doctor has prescribed different treatments for them, and that can often be a reason that helps bring people that causes a crisis to come into the hospital. So there's that piece.
Your study says that even with the 122 beds added in this three-way contract program, the number of beds available to mental health patients in crisis that can be treated in 7 days or less falls short of the need. What is the need? How much more would it cost to increase the level of beds needed?
Well, I think we don't know the answer to that question, and that was one of our suggestions to the General Assembly. Is I think it's time for North Carolina to develop a methodology to determine how many beds and which different types of beds are needed in each region of the state. I think it's going to be important that it not just be, we need a set amount of beds in North Carolina. I think they are going to have to look at this regionally, because in our research and talks with people across the state, the needs of the different regions vary enormously. And so I think what North Carolina is going to have to do is look at the different regions of the state and figure out how many short-term beds are needed, how many long-term beds are needed, and how we want to provide those going forward.
And what's the result of not having enough beds? Are people in need going to emergency rooms, increasing the burden there, or are they just simply falling through the cracks and in process endangering the public in some cases?
The emergency rooms that play an important role. They become the place where people turn. But also, as we mentioned earlier, the criminal justice system winds up playing a role in this as well. And so folks wind up in a way using that system. I mean, I know we don't always like to think of it that way, but from a certain point of view, the criminal justice system is almost a shadow mental health system.
Yeah, because you say that in 2010, more than 130,000 people across the state went to emergency rooms for mental and substance abuse problems. That was not, I would think, intended by this new three-way contract program, correct?
Well, it wasn't intended as part of the three-way contract program. It also was not, and it's an unintended consequence of mental health reform. So you talked about how North Carolina stacks up to other states. In New York, for example, they made a very conscious decision to have their emergency rooms on the front lines of mental health reform. And there are psychiatric emergency rooms in each region of their state. They are funded and staffed to do that work. Patients come in, and there's a computer system that looks at all the patients needing a bed statewide at that moment and all the beds that are available and gets patients to the appropriate bed. We don't have that in North Carolina. Patients have ended up going to emergency rooms, I think, because they don't know where to go. I think one of the reasons that they go there is they know they can go to the emergency room and get help. I'm not sure people know what an LME or local management entity is. But that's one of the things that the state's going to have to wrestle with going forward is the number of people needing mental health services that are flooding the ERs. And as John said, certainly I think one of the other consequences is that you may see the correction system serving a role in this going forward.
You know, given the number of gun-related tragedies we've witnessed in this country in recent months, particularly those in public places like movie theaters and schools, is that an indication that around the country there are too many people flying under the radar or falling through the cracks?
Well, I mean, I think we have heard in the wake of some of the shootings in the recent months more of an interest or a discussion of mental health issues and treatment, which I think is very important. I hope that maybe one good thing that comes out of these tragedies is the opening up of this conversation. The challenge is, however, I think as all of our studies show and all of our work on this issue is actually going to put the programs in place and putting the systems in place is a much more complicated process. And so it will take a lot of work to if we say we want a better mental health system, it's going to take an awful lot of work. And I think our study and our conversation this morning gives you a sense of just how complicated and how many different issues are in play here.
So do we have a better mental health system than we had in 1999, given the changes that we've made, the reforms that we've made? Is the system in place today more likely to prevent the kind of tragedies we've witnessed around the country from happening here?
You know, I think you would find a wide range of disagreement on that from different people in the system. So I think consumers would say that no, they would probably go backwards. But I think that's probably because of the instability more than how the system operates today. I think family members would have a different reaction. I think providers would have a different reaction. I talked to one provider in our report that talked about just how hard it is to cope with all these changes.
Mm. So we'll watch for further reports coming from the North Carolina Center for Public Policy Research on Mental Health. Mebben Rash and John Quinterno are co-authors of that organization's publication, Serving Mental Health Patients in Crisis. Thank you for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.